people know about that. We carry the book Satanic Crimes. And, of course, we have a four-tape set on satanic crimes about the pedophile network in Europe that involved the Bilderbergers, the most wealthy and powerful people in the world. That, of course, is the Franklin scandal, of satanic crimes, and, of course, the other book, A Terrible Mistake, about the scientists, government scientists, that they threw out the window. Well, ladies and gentlemen, please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg. And William Grigg was formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine, and certainly he today now has his own blog, he has his own radio program on the weekend. He's a regular guest here at Radio Liberty. He's an author, and Sidney's written a number of excellent books, but certainly one of the most articulate of our spokesmen. William Grigg, thank you very much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, as always, it's a pleasure and a blessing to be with you. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Well, tell us what we're going to talk about tonight.
I think one of the things that your listeners would have recognized over the last couple of weeks, and that many people of better than common perception would have noticed, is a splendid example of news management and perception management on the part of the custodians of acceptable opinion. Right after the Kentucky primary for the Senate race, the Republican primary, you had Randall Paul, an ophthalmologist from Kentucky, son of Ron Paul, the only consistent constitutionalist in the House of Representatives, when running away. It was really a lopsided victory over Mr. Grayson, the Republican establishment's candidate. Mr. Paul is a conservative of a constitutionalist bent, not as consistent as his father, but certainly better than most Republicans. Beginning immediately after his election, or after his victory in the primary, rather, he wasn't elected yet. He was nominated by the Republican Party to be their Senate candidate this fall. Immediately after that victory, you had a concerted, seamless full-court attack on Randall Paul, beginning with the smirking, sapphic snarkiness of Rachel Maddow, the cable news diva, who, by way of picking up on hints that had been laid in the local press in Louisville, tried to frame Randall Paul as a racist because of his opposition to the totalitarian measures. It's a soft totalitarianism, but it's totalitarianism in principle, being carried out by the federal government in the name of fighting discrimination in the private sphere as well as in terms of public, which is to say government institutions. And immediately following that ambush interview on CNBC, you had every news organ of consequence, whether on cable, in the print medium, or online, all these pretty much establishment-controlled news organs take up the notion that Randall Paul, while he might himself not be a bigot, is somebody whose constituency is heavily seasoned with old-line racists and crypto-white supremacists. And if Randall Paul and the type of conservatism he represents were to become ascendant, then suddenly we'd go back to the days of segregated lunch counters, segregated drinking fountains, the proverbial back-of-the-bus treatment for non-white Americans and so forth. It's all the most perfect nonsense. Most of it was done through greasy, slimy insinuation. But the meme was put out, cultivated for about 72 hours, and since that time, we've seen an effort to capitalize on this idea. It's something which has been latent and intermittent in terms of the way the so-called Tea Party movement's been portrayed. But we're hearing once again the classic cultural Marxist refrain that the federal government is the only thing that prevents Americans from devolving back to their incorrigibly racist ways. And that's something we're going to be hearing a lot more of in the next few months.
And yet, of course, many of the policies of the government are racist, terrible, terrible racism I'm talking about. Certainly their policies as far as the black people. And
yeah.
But of course, we're not allowed to talk about that. The fact that the government subsidizes Planned Parenthood, that specifically puts their abortion clinics into the black neighborhoods so they can kill unborn little black children. Where is the outcry about the government financing racism and that Planned Parenthood racism? We'll be right back in just a moment. The outcry is muted in its silence. Well, William, you go right ahead.
Picking up on something you said, Dr. Stan, the federal government, since before 1964, but certainly since 1964 and accelerating through the 70s, has pursued policies that are intended to cattle pen Americans by ethnic or racial background. I prefer to use the term ethnic rather than racial because, as far as I can tell, we're all the same race. That's what the 17th chapter of Acts says. Of one blood, God has made every kindred, every tongue of humanity. And the more important element is not the color of our skin, of course, but the color of the blood that was shed for all of us. But the federal government has been pursuing very avidly and in ill-disguised fashion policies intended to cattle pen all of us into these little ethnic ghettos and to define us according to a government-ordained collective by virtue of incidental characteristics such as the color of our skin or the ethnicity of our background, the pedigree of our parents, and so forth. This is being done for a couple of reasons, the first of which, of course, is that the government wants to make sure that we're all part of some collective constituency that's dependent on the government. The old divide-and-conquer strategy certainly play us off against each other, but more importantly, it's a way of keeping people in a condition of bondage. If we have to receive, on the basis of government policies, our means of living or our means of making a living, if we're dependent on the government's intervention to reconcile every conflict and to provide us with all good things, then obviously the people who are in charge of that arrangement are going to have us under their control. And so there's a certain paternalism here which plays into this, but once again there's a more sinister aspect here, and that is divide et imperia, the divide and conquer, the divide and keep conquered strategy. And this is what I'm really worried about. As the economy continues its downward course and things become more straitened and our economic circumstances become more dire, there are going to be manifold tactics employed by the establishment to keep people played off against each other, because the more that we're looking at each other, if you will, horizontally, that is, the more that the subjects look at each other as the problem on the basis of a characteristic that the government will define for our benefit, then the less inclined we are to unite on the common ground of principle. In this case, of course, the principle is individual liberty protected by law, for the purpose of dealing with those who aspire to rule us. And the more that we're played off against each other, the more secure the entrenched elite is. And the more envenomed and the more violent the conflict becomes, the greater their power will be over all of us. We can certainly see how this is being used, for instance, the immigration issue, where you have...
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment, I guess, is William Grigg, and we're talking about how they play us one group against another. Well, this is Dr. Stan. You go right ahead, William.
Yeah, with respect to the way the immigration issue has been framed and being pursued right now, it seems pretty clear to me that there is an effort to get people to be focusing on ethnicity at the expense of the principle of the rule of law that protects individual rights, protects free commerce, and protects property. if we were to define, for instance, the immigration issue in terms of the protection of property, that would pretty much take the racial element out of the entire equation. So what's being done right now, when you have this conspicuous spectacle of President Calderon of Mexico, who is a puppet, let's make something clear right now. Mr. Calderon is a puppet of Washington. If you take a look at the way that the money flows, if you take a look at whose name is on the paycheck and what the memo would be on the proverbial paycheck here, it's pretty clear to me that Calderon is a puppet of Washington. He, like his predecessors going back a number of years, and I think that Carlos Salinas is the most notorious example of this, is on the payroll of Wall Street, the Federal Reserve, and the people who run our government as well. Mr. Salinas, who's an accessory to murder, has gone into exile in Ireland, but he's able to cross the Atlantic in spite of the fact that his name is on an Interpol watch list, and apparently he's somebody who's still being sought in both Mexico and America, on the United States of America, that is, on various criminal matters, is able to attend meetings of the board of Dow Jones. And that's a pretty good example of the same sort of person Mr. Calderon is. He's been receiving literally billions of dollars from Washington in the name of the war on drugs, and what it amounts to is seed money to create this huge roiling conflict on the Mexican side of the border that is causing all kinds of hardship, bloodshed, and horrors of all kinds. They're literal acts of demonic terrorism that are taking place as the government-aligned narcotics cartels are fighting against other factions controlled by the government of Mexico. They're all receiving money from Washington, D.C., and this, of course, creates a situation where there are pressures being put to drive people north into the United States. And then you have Mr. Calderon appear on the northern side of the border here and lecture the United States about our shortcomings, both real and imagined, in a way that's almost perfectly pitched to this entire program we're talking about of pitting people against each other on the basis of race, ethnicity, and pedigree. And I think that that's one of the really good examples of the way this cynical game is being played by the same interests that are trying to depict those of us who are critical of the federal government's so-called civil rights policies as either bigots or the handmaidens of bigots. Now, Rand Paul is different from his father on a number of issues. He doesn't consider himself a libertarian. Ron Paul considers himself a small-R libertarian, a constitutionalist. He's a Republican. Rand Paul considers himself to be more conservative. But they both made the same point with respect to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which is that the federal government went well beyond its constitutional authority by insinuating itself into the management of private affairs in the interest of fighting discrimination. What that means is that every social relationship, every commercial relationship, every business transaction that takes place within the United States implicitly is under the scrutiny of the federal government with respect to discrimination. And what that means in practice is that at a time of the choosing of somebody who is part of a specially protected class or somebody who is representing as a bureaucrat the supposed interests of the specially protected class, anybody who's a property owner, a businessman, anybody who's an entrepreneur who is disinclined to do business with a person from that specially protected class could find themselves on the receiving end of a federal lawsuit or some kind of regulatory action in the supposed interest of stamping out private discrimination. What that means, basically, is that there's no such thing as private property, and there's no right to free association, there's no right to commercial freedom, because of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which, of course, originally applied to the so-called Jim Crow laws in the South, but also private acts of segregation, such as racially segregated diners, racially segregated accommodations, and things of that sort. What happened in the South after the Civil War and after Reconstruction, because of federal intervention during Reconstruction that created and exacerbated conflict between black and white in the South, is that a number of communities in the South enacted these laws for the purpose of preventing what had happened in Reconstruction, where you had the Reconstruction military governors putting together terrorist groups, however you want to characterize them, often operating through secret societies embedded in the Union League or the Loyalty League, who would work through armed, federally approved, federally sanctioned militias to terrorize and expropriate people who were part of the planter class in the South. That was the origin of the Ku Klux Klan, which is a perfectly abominable organization, a secret society that was the outgrowth of a number of pre-war secret societies. But its original intent was to do battle against the Union, the Northern occupation secret societies that were expropriating the planter class for the purpose of breaking down and destroying the antebellum culture in the aftermath of the war that the southern states had fought for their independence from Washington. And so you had a situation where it was really the intervention of the federal government in Reconstruction that prevented racial reconciliation from taking place in the South, because suddenly you had a situation where the carpetbaggers, the scalawag governors and scalawag officials were basically putting together mobs of previously dispossessed whites and previously enslaved blacks and using them basically to terrorize everybody else in the South. That was really the source of a lot of the hardened and revanchist attitudes on the part of the white Southerners that ended up coalescing into these awful, inexcusable Jim Crow laws. And doing away with Jim Crow, of course, was something that had to be done. The officially sanctioned government racism in the South had to be done away with. But what had happened as a result of Reconstruction was that there was this attitude on the part of many people in the South that if they didn't have these laws, they'd end up being on the receiving end of the same kind of treatment that their forebears had experienced. What happened in 1964 was that rather than dealing with the specific issue of government-imposed segregation, the government-imposed restraints on free commerce, which, of course, does not favor segregation. If you're interested in doing free commerce, you're worried about the color of people's money, not the color of their skin. Rather than focusing on that, the 1964 Civil Rights Act made the federal government the arbiter of every private relationship in the country. And that, of course, created a whole new frontier for racial conflict, because suddenly the federal government was going to scrutinize everything that you did as the owner of a rental property. If you were dealing with somebody, for instance, of my color, I'm dark brown, I'm often mistaken for black, I'm mistaken for Arab or Polynesian, I've passed for Greek, I've passed for Jewish, I've passed for Egyptian. If somebody were to deny me a rental, and that's happened before in my lifetime, if I wanted to, if I were possessed of a certain mischievous bent and completely deficient in character, I could go to any one of a number of agencies and file a racial discrimination claim, and on the basis of the 1964 Act and the enabling legislation, both state and federal, I could probably file a federal lawsuit and drive that rental property owner out of business if I saw fit to do so. This sort of thing happens all the time. I remember when I moved to Wisconsin in 1993, I was looking in the classified ads in the Milwaukee newspapers, and the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, the EEOC, which is an outgrowth of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, was putting ads in the classified section soliciting aggrieved would-be plaintiffs to file discrimination suits against businesses throughout Milwaukee and throughout Wisconsin, the major population centers in that state. They were literally chumming the waters here, hoping that somebody would rise to the bait, and then, to alter the metaphor slightly, these federal barracudas would chew to pieces any business that got in their way. That sort of thing happens all the time. That's one of the reasons why a lot of people end up being driven out of business and why it's difficult to employ certain people and why they're economically blighted communities in this country. It's not because of the supposed racism of people who want to do business. It's because of the institutional racism of the so-called civil rights apparatus. Well, this is the whole system against which Rand Paul was arguing, and unfortunately he's equivocated on the subject. He wasn't ready for this gale force wind of contrived theatrical indignation on the part of the people who were in charge of molding public attitudes. And so within 24 hours, he backtracked and said, yes, I would have supported the 1964 Civil Rights Act. What he had said originally was, if he had been in a position to do so, and bear in mind, he was still in swaddling clothes when the 1964 Civil Rights Act was being debated and being passed. But what he has said is that he would have modified it in such a way as to focus entirely on the issue of government discrimination and to leave matters in the private sector in the hands of the marketplace and in the realm of moral suasion. Now, it's a very important thing to recognize here that the so-called Civil Rights Act, the Civil Rights Movement, was not intended to emancipate individuals. The Civil Rights Act was intended to expand federal authority. It's a very important distinction that most people don't understand. The purpose of the Civil Rights Act, now most people think of sit-ins and boycotts, they think of people who were braving the water cannons and the attack dogs that were being unleashed by Bull Connor and his ilk. People look at that and they think that this was necessary in order to do away with officially sanctioned discrimination. I don't know whether or not there was some other way of doing away with officially sanctioned discrimination, but that was a worthy objective. But that wasn't the intent here. The intent of the Civil Rights Act was to ensure that the federal government would remain deeply involved in every element of commercial and private life in this country. There's a very important book on this subject by a Columbia Law School professor by the name of George P. Fletcher. The book is called The Secret Constitution. Mr. Fletcher is a credentialed academic. He's somebody whose outlook on politics would have to be described as Marxist. His economics are certainly Marxist. The way he approaches the concept of government power is Marxist or even Leninist. And in that book, he acknowledges something very important about the so-called Civil War that so-called right-wing critics, paleoconservatives, libertarians have long maintained, and that is that the war between the states was not intended to preserve or restore the Union. As he puts it, the purpose of that war was to create what he called a new constitutional order, which would be based on a unitary state rather than a confederated republic, which is what we had before the war. And the unitary state would be in charge of regulating all commercial, economic, and private life. And that's where we stand right now. In principle, we're living under a totalitarian regime. Occasionally in practice, but certainly in principle all the time.
And of course, the thing is, that's because people do not understand the Constitution, or that they pass these laws, are you able to modify certainly our relationship between the states and the federal government. But if you want to modify it, you do it by the amendment process, not by legislation. And this legislation is flagrantly unconstitutional. If you don't agree with it, let's amend the Constitution. They don't want to do that because they don't want the people to know the truth. Well, you go right ahead.
That's a very...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances? Even things which can cause sickness or disease. If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Certainly, it had nothing to do really with helping the blacks. It had to do with expanding federal power. And there really are people, and at that time there were the people, just as there are today, who want all power in Washington, D.C., so that now the federal government was going to be able, with this new power, to influence all interpersonal relationships. The significant thing about this was it was done by legislation. Now, if you want to change the structure of our government, why, you should amend the Constitution. But you see, the wicked people who want a dictatorship realize the American people don't want to give up their freedom. And so you hire a lot of people and you put them in office, and we have the finest politicians money could buy. And then you get them to go along with these issues. And then, of course, you control the media and you plague the politicians. And if you don't vote for the Civil Rights Bill, why, of course, you are a racist, but it has nothing to do with racism. I think we all agree that certainly every individual is made in the image and likeness of God, and certainly there's no justification for organized or even individual discrimination, but that is not a function of the federal government to determine, I mean, interpersonal relationships, especially when they don't cross any state lines, but it is all about the federal government controlling every aspect of our lives, a massive extension of federal control. That's what it was all about, and the average individual has never realized. Go ahead.
Exactly. If you go right now to my blog, Pro Libertate, at freedominourtime.blogspot.com, once again, that's freedominourtime.blogspot.com, or if you go to lourockwell.com, you or our listeners this evening can find my most recent essay, which is entitled Civil Rights and Total War, that outlines some of what we're discussing this evening. One of the very important quotes that I cite here is from a Princeton academic by the name of Melissa Harris Lacewell, and she's somebody who's deeply involved as a self-appointed watchdog in helping to compile the roster of people who express unsanctioned and unacceptable opinions on a number of subjects, so-called right-wing extremists. She's one of the watchdogs who feeds information into this whole apparatus of political surveillance, the SPLC, ADL, etc. She wrote an essay a few months ago for The Nation magazine in which she accused the so-called Tea Party movement of being seditionists, because the Tea Party movement, at least a large part of that cohort of people, believes that the federal government has exceeded its constitutional authority, and they don't believe that the federal government is a plenipotentiary body. This is seditious, according to Ms. Harris Lacewell. Now, she talked about the 1960s civil rights movement, and she made a couple of very important points about that movement that validate what I'm talking about here. What she says is that because in the southern states there was resistance to Washington's directives, she says, quote, the legitimacy of the central state was challenged. This is why the civil rights movement was so powerful. The overt abuse of state power, evidenced by the violence of Southern police, called into question their foundational legitimacy. The federal government had to act or risk losing its authority as a state altogether. Let me repeat that. This is important. The federal government had to act or risk losing its authority as a state altogether. You'll notice that in that description of the central achievement of the civil rights movement, there's nothing said about individual rights. It's all about validating, vindicating, entrenching, and enhancing the power of the central government. But it's the arbiter of all social relationships.
But it doesn't say anything about blacks and helping blacks. Wasn't that what it's all about? You see, it really wasn't about helping blacks until the black people understand that once again they've been used and exploited. But go right ahead.
Exactly. Later on, she talks about what she calls the unholy Hayes-Tilton Compromise of 1877. I would bet that not 1 in 10 million Americans understands that reference. The 1877 Hayes-Tilden Compromise was a literally dirty deal that gave Hayes the election. In 1876, the election went into extra innings the same way that it did in 2000. He had the guy who had fewer popular votes prevail because there was a deal struck in which southern states would give Rutherford B. Hayes their electoral votes in exchange for an end to Reconstruction. Reconstruction was a military dictatorship. It was an occupation of the conquered South, and what she's saying is that she regrets that military dictatorship ever ended. And that is the perspective she has here about what the civil rights movement's all about, using whatever force is necessary to compel the American public to submit to Washington's sovereignty. Later on, she talks about how the Tea Party movement threatens what she calls the end of our new Reconstruction. That's a really interesting phrase. Once again, if you understand that Reconstruction is military dictatorship, she's worried that that's going to come to an end. That's what really concerns her about the supposedly seditious Tea Party movement.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go right ahead, William.
It's very important, once again, to reiterate a couple of key points about the so-called civil rights movement. Once again, I think that the best way to do this is to go back and read what people who support this perspective have said. The civil rights movement was not intended to enhance the individual liberty of black Americans or merely to do away with government-instituted and government-imposed segregation. Government-imposed segregation, of course, is wrong. Racism, which is to say prejudice against somebody because of an incidental characteristic, is a moral outrage. It's a moral offense. The government doesn't have an open-ended mandate to abolish every evil. The government exists to protect the rights of the innocent against criminal aggression by the evildoers. And if government perverts that into a mandate to inflict segregation, inflict racism on people, then of course that's something that should be done away with. But the Civil Rights Movement, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, all of this was intended to exalt the central government and to make it omnipotent and omnipresent, rather, in the lives of Americans. That's part of a regime that a libertarian writer by the name of Ron Neff describes as polite totalitarianism, and I don't think I've seen it described any better than that. It's totalitarianism without the overt mailed fist, but it's a mailed fist, if you will, that's wearing elegant silk gloves as part of its evening attire. And that's the regime we're living under right now, and when Ron Paul dared to criticize it, however tentatively and unfortunately, however equivocally, he came under concerted fire by the state-centric media. The purpose of the state-centric media, of course, is to defend that order of things, is to defend and exalt the interests of the central government uber alles. And in the assault on Rand Paul, you see a very compelling illustration of something you've always said, Dr. Stan, which is that illusion is enthroned, and the people who are in charge of serving and perpetuating those illusions are deadly serious about destroying anybody who in any way challenges the ascendancy of the government's favored illusions. And I think that over the next several months, we're going to see a deepening and accelerating campaign to vilify, demonize, marginalize, neutralize those of us who understand the true constitutional order and what's happened as a result of the imposition of this order of polite.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, William is just saying that he really believes that during the next few months we're going to see more of an attack on those of us who really believe that the government is exceeding its authority, and certainly it is. Certainly there are certain things that the government is to do, certain things they're not to do, but we have a group of people working at the highest levels of our government and our institutions of, I would like to, and I'm not going to use the term higher learning, I would think of perhaps a higher degradation, or institutions of higher pornography, or call it what you will, but these are people who are basically using the educational system to put forward ideas which are really totalitarian in nature. They believe in the all-powerful state. They are part of the ruling elite, and of course, those of us who want to be free are the enemy. Well, before we go on, William, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your blog site, how they can hear your radio programs, and then, of course, how they can get to your PayPal button there at your website. Go ahead.
I do appreciate that, Dr. Stan. My blog and my radio show are both called Pro Libertate. And as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, those of us who love liberty are the enemies of the state. Pro Libertate means for freedom. And the blog, once again, is found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. A lot of what I publish at Pro Libertate, the blog, ends up being republished at lourockwell.com. The estimable Mr. Rockwell is the president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, which is a wonderful market-oriented outfit that really is the keeper of the flame of Austrian economics, that is to say hard money, hard currency, laissez-faire, taken at a very literal, on a very literal basis. But the blog itself, Pro Libertate, is at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, at the end of every essay, I do have a PayPal button, which can be used for those who have the means and the interest in donating to keep the blog up and, quite frankly, to support me and my family. This is how I make a living. I'm the street troubadour who's playing for tips with the hat or the guitar case there, soliciting whatever people feel impressed to give by way of a love offering. And that's to be found, once again, the PayPal button at the end of every essay that I publish on Pro Libertate. My radio program, which is broadcast on the Liberty News Radio Network, that's libertynewsradio.com, it's also called Pro Libertate. It's on every Saturday night from 8 o'clock till 11 o'clock Mountain Time, which is 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock California, or 9 o'clock till midnight Central. That's at libertynewsradio.com. If you go to the Liberty News Radio website, you'll be able to find a list of local affiliates. I believe there are a couple of dozen now. This is a very young venture. I think it's just a little more than a year old. But the programs are all archived there. If you have iTunes, you can receive them as podcasts. I think that there have been some bugs worked out in order to download those as podcasts. I've received some email communications from people who are frustrated over the podcasting function there. I think it's been fixed. If you're in the audience, I'm addressing the audience now, anybody in the audience who has been trying to listen to the program as a podcast, I think you can go to Liberty News Radio now and download the podcast. I think that's been fixed. I hope so. In any case, my shows are archived, as are all the shows of all the other hosts, and they can be listened to by way of streaming on the Internet as well. And there are, I think, at least a dozen different options there for those who want to listen to the program on online, which is, of course, the way that most of our audience listens to the program, as I've been very delighted to find out since moving to the weekends, which I think is a far better arrangement given my circumstances, a far better arrangement for me is to do the three-hour program on the weekends. I've found that we get a lot of international calls. We've gotten calls from all across the United States, from Canada, from Mexico. We've gotten some calls from overseas, and, of course, the Internet right now, particularly Internet broadcasting, is just a wonderful way of circumventing the self-appointed gatekeepers who are doing their level best right now, once again, to make sure that the audience, the public, remains their intellectual captives. So the program, once again, is on libertynewsradio.com. The blog is freedominourtime.blogspot.com, and I usually update the blog between 2 and 4 times a week as my situation permits. I also post items on the blog at lourockwell.com, and in the next couple of months I'm going to be publishing my sixth book. The working title right now is The Blood-Dimmed Tide, Reflections on the Rise of the Robber State. It's about 300 pages long. I'm still working on the manuscript. I've got the manuscript finished. I'm going through and doing a second draft editing on the manuscript before trying to get it ready for publication. I'm thinking of adding some more material to it, but it's basically, if you will, a work of near contemporary intellectual archaeology. I'm going back over the last 10 or 12 years and showing critical points, trying to analyze and demonstrate through the polemic writings that I've done, critical points that led to where we are right now. We were in a situation where, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, just a couple of minutes ago, people who want to have total power over our lives and direct and regiment our lives from Washington are now more or less pursuing that objective in an undisguised fashion. And you have a president now, it doesn't matter whether it's Mr. Obama or whoever would replace him in 2016, assuming, of course, that anybody replaces him, every president we're looking at right now is a potential president for life, a potential dictator, on account of the developments that I'm talking about in the last 10 or 12 years in this book. It doesn't really matter whether you're talking about somebody who's got the Republican label or the Democrat label. You're talking about basically fungible variants on the same theme of corporate socialism, with, of course, a couple of variations just for the purpose of branding. Obama is not the same flavor of collectivist that George W. Bush was. And George W. Bush was a slightly different flavor of collectivist than Bill Clinton was. But they all exist within a very narrow band on the political spectrum. And they serve the same constituencies, which are clustered around Wall Street and, for the most part, this semi-entrenched power elite that has been defined by people like Carol Quigley and has been readily identified and now doesn't really bother to disguise its actions or its intentions as much as it used to. And it's important for people, and one of the reasons I'm publishing this book, it's important for people to recognize that they have to get rid of their fixation on party labels and personalities. They need to understand what is being done to us in terms of the claims that are made for the powers that are exercised by the ruling oligarchy and whatever figurehead for that ruling oligarchy happens to be in power at any given time. And so that book, The Blood-Dimmed Tide, should be out in the next couple of months. And as soon as it's ready, Dr. Stan, I'll let you and your audience know. And I'm sure that it's going to be very well publicized on Pro Libertate, the blog, and probably on LouRockwell.com as well.
Well, I hope that you get an adequate number printed and we'll be able to carry it as well. So anyway, go right ahead, because I think that this whole subject is so important. People have to understand there really is an elite, and certainly Mr. Obama is not the President of the United States. He may be referred to as such, but he's simply a figurehead for the power elite. And it was the same power elite that put George Bush in power and Bill Clinton in power and George H.W. Bush. Yes, and even Ronald Reagan. Yeah. And they all played their part. Some of them are better looking. Some of them speak better. Some of them perhaps have a little better moral tenor, but they are all moving us in the same direction. And that is towards ever more government power, certainly towards this whole globalist concept of transferring America's wealth and certainly America's manufacturing and industry to other nations. It's all part of a globalist movement of bringing about a world government. Once you understand that, everything going on makes sense. The attitude towards immigration, the coming war with Iran, our invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, all of these things begin to make sense when you understand there is another agenda behind everything going on today. Go right ahead.
That's a very good point. By way of illustrating how easily people are misled, or how easily the understandable concerns of people can be exploited and co-opted, I'd like to share with you and your audience something that I got in my inbox just yesterday. And this is the sort of thing that happens all the time. I just know in my bones, but I can't prove yet, that somewhere in the Pentagon or on K Street, there is somebody in a basement office who does nothing but generate and disseminate these email chain letters that get sent around. Some of them are sent to people who are hardline Republican-centered conservatives. Some of them are sent to people who are hardline Democrat Party-centered progressives. But I'm certain that somebody generates these things and goes out and chums the water with them. This one was an outraged email talking about the proposed amnesty for illegal immigrants. And what it says is, CNN News, not Fox, you will not believe this. Then it talks about the idea that there's this amnesty bill before the Congress that is being promoted by the Obama administration, and that this is something that even CNN is getting upset about. And this is attached to a file that was a video of a program on CNN talking about an amnesty bill that Representative Boehner had referred to using an expletive, using, if you will, a very grimy and unfortunate expletive. And the thing is, this was put out 3 years, almost to the day, after that news clip had originally aired on the Lou Dobbs program on CNN. This is in 2007 when Lou Dobbs was talking about this amnesty bill that, among other things, was talking about providing all kinds of foreign aid to Mexico for the supposed purpose of helping to build their economy so as to keep Mexican citizens on the Mexican side of the border. It would provide amnesty for Mexicans of Mexicans who had come here without legal status, who were members of street gangs, things of that sort, all these horrible things. The email, which was disseminated to several dozen of my friends, I think I was probably the 20th, 30th name on this email chain, talked about the idea that this is what the Obama administration is doing, is trying to create this huge new constituency here that would be attached to the Democratic Party. Now, I'm not trying to say that the Obama administration is not trying to do this. That strikes me as something that, of course, the Obama administration wanted to do. The Clinton administration did the same thing. And really, that's been more or less in the Democratic playbook since 1965, since the Immigration Reform Act of 1965, which was designed, I believe, to create a ready-made clientele for the Democratic-controlled Great Society welfare state. All these things happened in pretty much the same window of time between roughly 1963 and about 1972. But it's bipartisan, and that's the point that I'm going to make about this email and this immigration proposal. What I wrote to my friends by way of trying to help them understand that they had played was the following. This amnesty proposal is horrible, but Obama had nothing to do with it. It was proposed by George W. Bush in 2007. Then I proposed, I attached a specific link to a Washington, D.C. political newsletter that in contemporaneous terms pointed out that every one of these horrible things that they thought the Obama administration was doing had been done, was being done, by the Bush administration 3 years ago. And this, once again, points out and underscores the fact that we're dealing with a near identity between the leadership of the two parties. There are variations within the form. There's an acceptable range of diversity here, meaning that rather than playing to the pro-life constituency, Obama plays to the pro-abortion constituency. Mr. Bush gives lip service to the pro-life constituency, then he ends up working with people in Congress to appropriate tens of millions of dollars for taxpayer funding of Planned Parenthood both here and abroad.
Illusion, reality is usually scoffed at, and illusion is usually king, and people don't understand. I mean, I get so sick and tired of them just saying what a terrible guy Obama is. Yes, he is a terrible guy, but he's doing in many things exactly the same thing as George Bush does, and people don't understand. We have a one-party system. They shift these people back and forth, but the powers that be working behind the scenes who tell the president what to do, and that repeat that, who tell the president what to do, who write his speeches, they're all that continue right along from administration to administration, and nothing changes. Go right ahead.
Yeah, exactly right. What they do is they fill this dog dish, and they define to the last rung, if you will, to the last link, rather, the length of his chain. And so Mr. Bush is allowed to make certain types of speeches. Of course, he's not allowed to go out actually to speak in person when they have the Right to Life rally in January of every year. He had to talk by way of telephone hookup. That's actually something that started under Ronald Reagan. Interestingly enough, under Ronald Reagan in 1983, you actually had a sitting president who published in book form a polemic against abortion, which I thought was quite commendable. It was just basically reprinted speeches that he had given. But he was the one who did the most that was permitted a president to do by this unseen oligarchy you're talking about. And all he was able to do basically was pay lip service to those ideals and make some, you know, makes some interesting and sometimes somewhat commendable but extremely limited and very reversible changes in the bureaucratic decoration, if you will, in Washington, but nothing of substance happened. But he was able to go that far and no further, whereas Obama, of course, has to triangulate somewhat, but he's allowed a little bit more leeway because his views, he's the one who was captured on audio tape talking about how it would be a punishment if one of his daughters were to become pregnant out of wedlock, would be a punishment not to kill his grandchild, which is really a perverse way of thinking about it. As a father, as somebody whose fondest aspiration would be to see my grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, I couldn't possibly encompass the concept of thinking that the death of one of my grandchildren would be one of the worst things that could possibly happen to that grandchild, obviously, but also to my child, my daughter, and it was something I considered to be a horrible thing. But Mr. Obama, in a candid moment, was saying that I wouldn't want to punish my daughter with a baby if she made a mistake. Well, that's not a punishment. I mean, if you make a mistake, ironically enough, it's part of God's bottomless grace that you end up with a blessing. And quite frankly, when I talk about this subject, Dr. Stan, I have to point out, I'm an adopted child from a family of 6 adopted children. I almost certainly was born to a troubled teenager. I don't know my birth parents. My father was most likely an illegal immigrant from Mexico. I don't know anything about my biological father apart from the fact that he was, well, I can tell you this much, he wasn't Swedish because I'm assuming that he was Mexican. That's what I've been told. My mother was a young girl from Idaho of Irish extraction. I've never met her. I'd love to meet her. I'd love for her to meet her grandchildren. But when I talk about the right to life issue, this is something that, quite frankly, is a matter of a visceral, passionate commitment for me as somebody who, but for a tick of the clock, in terms of the vast sweep of history, might very easily have found himself being aborted. And I take a look at my 5 siblings, and I think, one of whom was born after Roe versus Wade. Any of us could have been destroyed by the curette. So this is a subject about which I'm somewhat passionate. So please forgive my long digression on that topic. But this is a really good illustration of the way that the constituencies are set up. One pro-life, one pro-abortion. But the thing is, we're basically here in order for each side to score rhetorical points off the other.
But really, the abortion issue is just used to give the to divide us. We get the pro-life, pro-choice, pro-family values, pro-homosexual. It's all showbiz, ladies and gentlemen. It's political theater. And we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Understand, reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. Go right ahead. We've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program tonight, William.
Yeah, Dr. Stan, thanks once again for this opportunity, and thanks for indulging me as I went on.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look. I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
Well, I was horrified when I saw the plight of the people in Haiti after the earthquake, but a similar event could happen right here in the United States, and that's why you should call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD, that's 866-404-FOOD, and purchase a supply of his products. Freeze-drying is a great way to preserve food. I know because I bought a supply 40 years ago, and when I opened a can recently, the food was as fresh and tasty as when I purchased it. We're living in uncertain times, so if you'd like to have a supply of ground beef, diced beef, chicken, vegetables, or fruit on hand,
Call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-FOOD. And mention you heard about him right here at Radio Liberty.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.